When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This land is my land, this land is your land, from California to the New York Island, from the Gulf Stream water to your sparkling deserts, this land belongs to you and me.
Well, that's as panoramic as they come, and as the man said, there is quite a lot of America, but we have to begin somewhere, so why not on the New York Island, that is to say, on the island of Manhattan. And here we have a native of Manhattan who has now come to live in Dublin, Kevin Sullivan, former dean in Columbia University, and Sean J. White, who until recently spent some time in an office bang in the middle of Fifth Avenue, which some people regard as the center of the universe.
Fifth Avenue is a kind of core of Manhattan, not only of Manhattan, but I suppose of America. And one did feel there's a big city feeling about Manhattan, but also one did feel the sort of extended village thing, that Manhattan is also a long series of villages. And in fact, it was in another of those villages, the village, that Kevin Sullivan and myself met most frequently. We hardly ever met uptown. We always tended to meet in the more comfortable environs of Greenwich Village. I think this is a necessity to have in New York a number of villages.
Kevin Sullivan, you're a native son, of course.
Yes, I was born on Manhattan Island. I was born in the northern part of the island at 105th Street and Morningside Avenue. This has now become an integral part of Harlem, though at the time it was a very Irish neighborhood. Though most of my adult life was spent in, as Sean says, in Greenwich Village, which has a quality about it that is indeed that of a village within a city. Manhattan itself is the central borough of the city, and sometimes people forget that New York City is an island city. There is Manhattan, there is Staten Island, and of course there's Long Island with the other two boroughs on it. The one part of the city that is also part of the mainland, so to speak, is the Bronx. And it's in the Bronx that I spent my boyhood. And I had a rather depressing experience here about 5 years ago. I was driving home from Columbia University one afternoon, and I saw this great sign called the Bronx County Expressway. And I thought I would go over and see the old neighborhood that I had grown up in as a boy. It's around the Claremont Park section. I got over to that area, and I found that what had been, when I was a boy, a very lovely section of the Bronx. Indeed, when the family first moved there, there were apple orchards across the street. There were cows grazing at the top of the street. There was a great house further up the street where people kept horses and manufactured horseradish. This particular section of the city has now been covered with a great slab of macadam, and there are slums festering on either side of this highway. I mention it because I think it's one of the symptoms of a physical decay that is coming up on various parts of the city.
Of course, not confined to that city.
No, I'm afraid it's happening in our own city too. We don't quite get the same stretches of macadam or the sort of fearsomeness of highways and motorways, although looking at the new Cork traffic plan, one is a little apprehensive as to what might happen in Cork, which is to me also a very delightful city and a city I've lived in and hold very dear, that the kind of flyovers and things could happen in Cork, as happened in so many American cities, as happened in the Bronx, as Kevin has described, and has taken the life completely out of a great number of cities in the Midwest of America. But just Kevin talking about his West Side upbringing, I lived on the West Side of New York, and that was something we both had in common too. Although we met in the Village, we were both sort of radically West Siders, and this is a great division in New York.
You mean like North Siders in Dublin?
Right, East Side, West Side, all around the town. But East Side is predominantly now means fashionable, and West Side means unfashionable. And the particular part of the West Side I lived in, I suppose you would describe as a kind of Jewish intellectual ghetto inhabited by people like Andre Kostelanitz
and his orchestra.
And his orchestra, all of them. Mark Connolly, the playwright, yes. Paul O'Dwyer, Padraig Colum, Jim Downey. It was another kind of extended village, mostly people in the arts, people in music and such trades along Central Park West.
Sounds like an extended Grafton Street area to me.
A little bit. Grafton Street, perhaps, and Baggot Street combined. That's Gothic, the kind of area it was. But it had been, funnily enough, too, before I went there, it had been an Irish community. And this was visible still in the church, the parochial structure. Our church, Holy Trinity, had an Irish pastor and a very determined, quite recognisable Irish parish priest character, although he was American, a little authoritarian, but very human at the same time. But his parishioners now were mostly Puerto Rican. And in fact, there was even another grade who were depressed in turn by the Puerto Ricans. They were the Haitians who just came in. And you had a good example of this in the way masses were arranged. The best hours for mass were English masses, slightly less good hours, and I presume this is the pastor's arrangement, went to Spanish masses. And finally, at 2:30 in the afternoon, was the French mass for the Haitians.
The melting pot. Has New York melted really into it? Isn't there a single New York thing in spite of all these shades and colours?
No, I don't believe there is at all. Even if you just consider Manhattan Island itself, Sean had been talking about the West Side. Well, you take the upper part of the Manhattan Island, the West Side there, beginning at around 96th Street, say. Where Columbia University begins around 114th. But here you have an academic section of the city, north of which you have a kind of middle-class section, largely Irish and Jewish. And, of course, to the east of that, east of Manhattan at that section, is Harlem, the world's greatest ghetto. In the center of the city, what I mean by the center of the city here, the center of Manhattan Island, between, let us say, 14th Street and 96th Street, the east side here is the east side that Sean has been talking about, the fashionable east side. As a matter of fact, when I was living in New York, I was teaching at Columbia University, and spending a good deal of time in the village, having indeed living in the village for many years, and one had to lead a kind of schizophrenic life. It was very seldom that I found myself in the center of New York. I'd either be in the northern part of the island in an academic community, or I would be in Greenwich Village. And the great attraction of Greenwich Village, of course, is not... I talk about the Greenwich Village not of the tourist, but of the one section of New York that is still a neighborhood, you know, where you can walk out in the streets, as you walk out in the streets here in Dublin, and you'll see friends, you know, and you'll know where they live. It's a quality of the section of the city that is not true of the east side, for example. Well, much less, I think, Sean, of the west side.
Well, I agree this is true about Greenwich Village, but, you know, the cliches about everywhere, you know, the Irish ones, if you walk along O'Connell Street, you'll meet everybody in Dublin, you know, or meet everybody in Ireland, you know. But I've had this experience walking along Fifth Avenue, meeting Irish people, meeting English people I didn't know were in America. And I think the other cliche, of course, of this bustling, unfriendly city. Certainly there's violence and certainly there's pressure, but also I think the people of New York, in my book, are a very friendly people. And you find in stores and in restaurants and bars and shops generally, you find a degree of friendliness and tendency to help you out and give you information or to talk that doesn't exist in the cliché at all. That, in fact, you can also see people on Fifth Avenue, recognise people on Fifth Avenue, perhaps not as much as the village, but you certainly can.
I think you're right, that it is a friendly city. They succeed, however, in concealing their friendliness to an extraordinary extent. However, do you know, there was a crisis here about 6 years ago, in the great blackout in the fall of 1965. Now, that was an example in which the friendliness, indeed the affection of the city, came out. You'd find people who ordinarily you'd cross to the other side of the street if you saw them. But during that blackout, here they were out in the middle of the street, taking the place of cops, everyone trying to help everybody else. The most extraordinary manifestation of a civic relationship.
Yeah. London during the Blitz.
Yeah, I was going to say I missed that blackout. I arrived in America just after that, but the stories were still current. Everybody had their blackout night story, rather like the Londoner and the Blitz. It was New York's finest hour, one gathered. But there was even a more recent one there, which actually occurred, I think, since I've been here and since you've come over here, Kevin. That was the police strike. And I think, again, there was a police strike there for quite a number of days, and I think it's quite inconceivable that a city as overtly violent as New York should, in fact, conduct its business and should go on in a lawful way about its business with the police on strike.
That is remarkable. You know, there's one question, though, that I feel one is at the back of all our minds, and it has to come out. You know, it has been suggested over and over again by people who are not normally alarmists that New York is... tragically, the example, with all the splendid things that can be said about that, it is perhaps the first example of the city running down, the city thing, the city, the machine that is a city, not beginning to work. And how far do you think this is true?
Well, I've been under the impression for the past couple of years that New York is as it presently constituted, ungovernable. Simply ungovernable. The motto, I think, during the summer is New York is a city festival. Well, by God, it's nothing of the sort. Mayor Lindsay might be a summer festival. But though I think the man is incompetent, I doubt very much whether you'd have anybody who would be able to run a city of that size and that complication.
Yes.
At all.
I'm not talking about violence or that sort of thing now at all. I'm simply talking about the
services.
Is it possible, yes, is it possible on that scale to maintain that sort of service?
Well, I remember Brendan Behan once saying about Toronto, it would be a fine city when they had built it, when they had finished it. I have a feeling about New York that really never was finished and that these kind of troubles have occurred at all stages of its career. I'd also take issue with Kevin on the summer festival and Mayor Lindsay aspect of his remarks, because I know Lindsay has a hell of a job.
That was a Democrat talking.
But, Lindsay is not a very Republican, is he? I think he's more a Democratic Republican.
That's what I have against him.
Just from my experience of the sort of summer in New York, and I have spent two summers actually in New York, right in the center, and I lived quite near Central Park, and the Lindsay administration had organized some wonderful things there, like open-air concert, open-air opera. I have been at an opera in the Sheep Meadow in Central Park with 3,000 people sitting down on the grass, having their supper and listening to the best of opera at the same time. That was free, no tickets, and it was very well controlled, and there was no problem of either violence or crowding.
Well, it would be typical. It would be typical of an administration with a man like Lindsay at its head that he would supply luxuries before he'd supply necessities. Let him collect the garbage before he provides concerts in the parks.
Bread before circuses, circuses before bread. It's the oldest of all the urban problems. The Romans had a word for it. Robin Roberts was singing a while ago that land was her land. Robin, of course, that city is your city too.
Yes. It took me a long time to admit it because I'm a Westerner from Utah, but I've lived there most of my life, when I'm not here, that is. And I'm very fond of New York, especially when I'm out of it. After 3 months, I think it might be a decent place to go back and live for the winter.
How do you feel about what our pundits were saying?
Oh, don't get me on that. There are many things I disagree with. I do feel that there is a West Side kind of neighborhood. I feel it very strongly. I'm an actor, mainly, and I'm always meeting other actors in that neighborhood. Oh, between 90th Street, say, where I live, and 70th. Because it's cheap. It's always been fairly cheap on the West Side. All the theaters on the West Side, the little theaters, the Actors Studio, the dance studios, all of them. The East Side is, we wouldn't think of going over there. You know.
Well, then it's such a friendly city, although when there was a reference to a friendly city, I think you said under your breath there when you were listening, you were saying, yeah, if you're not mugged.
Yes, well, we have a policeman on our block that we pay for. And it's a good idea. He's utterly harmless, and he doesn't carry a weapon, but he's there walking back and forth with a uniform. And I was mugged by a cat. It's the only mugging I've ever had. He ran out of an alley and tore my leg up in little pieces, and I was standing there sort of hollering for this man. He said, "Heavens, I'll call the police." So he came back after about 15 minutes and said the line was busy. So I had to fend for myself. But I figured it was because I was rehearsing Macbeth and there's a curse, you know.
Ah, yes.
But many friends of mine have been mugged, and they're all rather nice about the muggers for some reason. Well, one of my friends had her kneecap broken, and she said, "Oh, well, it wasn't his fault, I slipped."
You support your friendly neighborhood mugger.
Yeah, well, a lot of them are very poor little nervous fellows who want their fix, you know, and there you are, a big grown-up. And so on. You say, "Well, just take it easy." And a friend of mine did this and said, "Here's the money, but please give me back my identification," which he did.
All this, I presume, is all very well provided you're, what does the song say? If you're white, that's all.
You're
right.
All right.
How does that go?
Oh, there was a big Bill Brunsey song a long time back. Sort of went, "If you're white, that's all right. If you're brown, stick around. But if you're black, oh, brother, stand back, stand back, stand back."
The tragedy and the comedy of the black-white relationships have been sung all over the place, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, the situation has greatly changed now, and anybody who says it hasn't is wrong. In some ways, it's worse. But I think from a point of view of the dignity of the black people, it's much, much better, because they literally have stood up. You know, and they're saying, "This is my right and I'm going to have it." And the difficulty was for some of us to get it to calling our friends who were, you know, practically as light as maybe lighter. he's black, and, you know, when they're not black at all, but it's a kind of badge of honor, because Negro has become a term meaning middle class Uncle Tom, in a way. So you say, "Well, so-and-so is black," even though, you know, she may not be or he may not be.
It's all different from the days of Jim Crow. I mean, as you say, it could be possibly worse. I mean, that's a matter for argument, but it's different.
I think it's better, because people are really, you know, you've got a lot of black people, you know, senators and congresswomen and so on in Washington, really standing up and being articulate. You have an awful problem now of unemployment among blacks and whites, and mostly among blacks. And you wonder, you know, why these guys become violent and go around creating trouble. You have 30% of your black youth unemployed. You've got a big problem. But they're not sitting back and saying, "Well, that's the way it is," you know.
Yeah.
They're saying, "You do something about it."
The problem is about as easy, as simple, as tractable as the problems of the north of Ireland. But two outside sympathetic observers here now on this question of colour and race. In the United States, Senator John Horgan, who is a frequent visitor, and an English novelist who lives in New York and who is on a brief visit to Ireland, Wilfred Sheed.
Well, I think that Americans are probably less racist than most people would be given the opportunity. I remember when the English used to sneer at the American race situation. You may find it hard to imagine an Englishman sneering before they found one of their own, and the French likewise. In general, Americans are used to an improvised sort of society in which anybody can move in or move out, but when they settle down, it does come to a question of who gets the good houses. So I would say, particularly in the North, it's a real estate question, as many questions are in America. The South is very, very difficult to type. I had a story written by a student of mine at Princeton, and he was from the South, and it was about a young fellow returning home and embracing a Negro friend in the street. And I asked whether this was common practice, and he looked at me as if I was mad. Of course it was. And yet most Northerners would have the understanding that Southerners wouldn't do that. On the other hand, when it comes to coming into the house, there the line would be drawn. They would be friendly. You know, the sort of day-to-day commerce is very mellow and pleasant, I would say, in the South. But there is this thing about not allowing them across the... You allow them in the kitchen, but not in the front.
How did you see it when you were there, John? How did you... Did this strike you? Did you...
I suppose that my impression, which is a very fleeting one, would back up what Wilfred is saying very strongly. My first experience of America was of New York and the East Coast, where the whole race problem was a frightfully an angst-ridden thing. And later on, when I went to the South, it was easy to feel that things were in some ways so much worse and yet in some ways so much better. I often wonder whether this was simply the question of relative population pressures, that the places I was in the South were small town or even rural areas in which you could identify the problem in terms of individual people rather than in terms of huge blocks of people as in the cities in the North.
Which would suggest that at least part of the problem is the problem of
urbanization,
alienation, and loss of personal identity, thinking of people as blocks of humanity rather than as people.
Yes, I was saying also to Wilfred just a moment ago that I think there are probably areas, even in the crisis city areas, on the fringes, where there is a de facto integration of a sort. My sister lives in a place in the village which has three-way integration, if you like, between Puerto Ricans, blacks, and European Americans, and this seems to be quite natural and be working quite well. It may be on the way to de-integration, either one way or the other. But for the time being, at least in a tiny little pocket, it seems to be working.
But that is in Greenwich Village.
In Greenwich Village, just on the fringes of Greenwich Village.
Yes, where people would be slightly different anyway, wouldn't they, about this sort of thing? Wouldn't their attitudes be different? Well, I don't know.
I suppose they would be to a certain extent, yes.
Tell me this, though. Do you feel that, Wilfred, that this, the old master-servant relationship, or almost owner and owned relationship, I mean, by which people refer to our Negroes, you know, this classic thing in the South, has the disappearance of that left a terrible vacuum? Is this really that the whites are sort of looking around for for somebody to belong to, or to somebody to have belonging to them?
Well, I don't know that much about the South. If I could just stick to the North for a minute, and to John's point, the places like Greenwich Village are mixed neighborhoods in a very much more general sense. The average American suburban life is stratified in so many ways. You find these liberals who have no Negro friends and are ashamed of it and try to find some. But in point of fact, they don't have friends of any different sorts. Their friends are drawn from their own kind of job, and meeting a Negro would be no more difficult than meeting a blue collar worker or something of that kind. So as you fan out from the city, you find more and more stratified communities, and I think that the race problem has somehow crossed this.
You know the old saying that Negroes were invisible. Yeah, just the way we in Ireland
Protestants were invisible.
On another level, that travellers, itinerants, were invisible, or if visible only as part of the scenery, the landscape. Do you think that we perhaps our attitudes towards itinerants have certain parallels with some American attitudes towards blacks?
Yes, in the sense that they're problems which occupy the public consciousness only intermittently, and very often quite in a manner which is quite unrelated to their relative importance in society. I think I don't know that one can stretch the parallel too far, but you know, I would agree with you that this does happen very often in this country.
Has the Black Power movement, which took over from just the advancement of the coloured people idea, has this Black Power movement, has it lost impetus recently, do you think? It seems to me, or is it just that it's working way more quietly and isn't hitting as many headlines?
Well, I think the consensus is that it never had terrific influence among the blacks themselves. It used to be the joke of non-black power blacks that they couldn't get out 10 votes. Stokely Carmichael would be absolutely worthless. His only particular value was as a goad to the white community. And in some ways, the black rage, which has now become a stereotype, is the other side of the comic black servant. Black insolence is now a stereotype as being a funny Negro used to be.
Could I come in on this and wonder whether there's something in this isolationism of black power, which has a parallel here too, in abstentionist political movements, which gain a tremendous aura of romanticism from their abstentionist tactics, but really neglect the basic political tasks in society of educating people to change their own options.
Yes, the reformist task, the revolutionary sneering against reform, is that your idea?
No, not necessarily. I would say that you can be a revolutionary and not be an abstentionist. What I'm talking about is you know, the kind of abstentionist self-created ghetto in which they safeguard the purity of aims and purpose by refusing to contaminate it with anything that might normally be described as politics.
Do you think that's fair enough?
Well, yes, there's a cynical centrist Negro, such as Claude Brown, would say that because these people cannot get out their own people's vote, they say the vote is worthless, that the political process is worthless. Oddly enough, the most intelligent Negro political activity would be in the South, where they have, in fact, taken over a large wing of the Democratic Party. And one of the things that I suppose passed unnoticed in the Democratic Convention in 1968 and was quite thrilling, if you've been following this for a long time, was that the Mississippi delegation voted the peace plank and voted for Eugene McCarthy. This would have been unheard of 10 years ago.
Yes. So monoliths do crack.
Yes, I think where they find that political activity is useful, immediately they see the point of it. When it's not, then they start ranting.
Do you think there is a future, then, for this sort of slow process of, as you said, educating people to be able to choose their options?
I would think so, and to come right back to the beginning, I wouldn't be ultimately as pessimistic, you know, about the race situation in the States as many outside observers are.
How do you feel, though, the general question of the other America, does this tie in with the question of the other America, poor America, and how large a problem is this and how intractable a problem is it?
Well, there's one sense, I suppose capitalism is the enemy, but capitalism has certain compensating advantages, and it is people like Nelson Rockefeller and so on who are building banks and so on in Harlem because they would like to have another market there. And it rather astonished me about the northern situation here, which Ms. Devlin considers a classic capitalist oppression, that if they were real capitalists, that is to say, fanatical moneymakers, they would not want such a disintegrated situation to last.
Yes, perhaps what Ms. Devlin doesn't sufficiently differentiate between is a sort of proto-capitalism inherent in feudalism and the...
Yes, it seems like a feudal situation to me, the North.
But you do think that this problem of poverty in America, which does, in fact, which, of course, has been so much the problem of black America, just to an extent,
yes.
Do you feel that this is gradually being eroded?
Well, there is now a black middle class of the most excruciating respectability who are certainly as narrow in their lives as the white middle class. And this, the problem with these people is that as well as being more able than their brothers, they tend to separate from their brothers. These are the ones who will not help the black movement in any way. So that the split between the successful and the unsuccessful blacks is one of the things that the black power people are goading at within their own people. They are saying you're an Uncle Tom, in other words. That's what Uncle Tom is about.
I'd say that this provokes another split, which perhaps is a little bit overdue in the ranks of the white liberals, between those who do see the question essentially as a question related to poverty, wealth, and so on, and those who, I count some of my friends among them, who have suddenly discovered, see their main aim as the creation of a black middle class, as a solution to the problem, which of course it is in their terminology, but not necessarily in everybody else's. And this does set up tensions even within the white liberal camp, and I think this is quite a good thing. It's sorting people out.
I'm going back to that red clay country. I'm going back to that red clay country. I'm going back to that red clay country. That's my home, baby. That's my home. Well, old Hannah, come to the window. Well, old Hannah, come to the window. Well, old Hannah, come to the window. Wave goodbye, baby. Wave goodbye. This old hammer made of silver. This old hammer made of silver. This old hammer made of silver. Rings like gold, baby. Rings like gold. Take this hammer, throw it in the river. Take this hammer, throw it in river. Take this hammer, throw it in the river. Keep on ringing, baby. Keep on ringing. This old hammer killed John Henry. This old hammer killed John Henry. This old hammer killed John Henry. Killing me, baby. Killing me. I'm going back to that red clay country. I'm going back to that red clay country. Going back to that red clay country. That's my home, babe. That's my home.
Well, that says a good deal more than perhaps any of us could say in half an hour's conversation about the subject.
Do you think so? I like that song because it expresses two things. I'm never going to get this big hammer out of my hand because there's nowhere to go, even if I throw it in the river. But I love my place that I come from, that red clay country. You know, there is great love among the black people from, you know, the South. And even, by God, Harlem. You know, be a nice place to live if they just clean out the heroin and the rats and the garbage.
Yeah. John Henry is a great folk hero, of course, really, isn't he?
Yeah, it's one of our few really indigenous ballads, and the line that they use for the film, "A man ain't nothing but a man," is you know, very, very poetic.
You know, how far does a figure like that command loyalty? How far is he a party symbol, you know what I mean?
A party symbol?
Well, you know what I mean by a party. I don't mean democratic, republican, I mean... But you know the way in which a noble thing can become a party thing?
Mm.
And it does... Would America... Is there a way in which John Henry, everybody would say, would be proud to...
Yes.
Yes.
I think John Henry is, you know, beyond being a black hero, is an American hero like Paul Bunyan or, you know, whatever, Billy the Kid. We have an awful lot of outlaws that are heroes.
Even among your so-called silent majority?
Yes, I think so, insofar as they listen to folk songs. I think a lot is misunderstood about the silent majority or whatever it is. As Jack Deasy was saying, you know, you shouldn't put down those people. They're very decent people. They feel they aren't being represented, and they're sort of chomping at the bit because things are going bad for them as it is for everybody in a country that's at war, where you have a lot of problems, but they're good fellows in that, you know, among those hard hats. And I've always felt that people who work together had a lot more in common than people, you know, of the same, you know, whether they're black or white or, you know, class-wise.
You know, leaving aside the term silent majority, does the ordinary, uncommitted person, you know, the people who don't, in fact, who haven't made their minds up on things, you know, in any country, there's a problem as to how far, you said people listen to folk song, how far do people listen to anything? I put this question the other day to, you know, Harry Reasoner.
Right, yeah, surely.
Anchorman on one of your...
ABC.
ABC News. And I asked him, did he think, like, I mean, that, you know, do the media, in fact, influence public opinion? In fact, do people listen?
Oh, I think so. I suppose every journalist gets discouraged over a period of time when you write or broadcast something which seems clear and simple to you, and then the mail indicates that people are just not listening at all. But I think that's a small percentage. I think people do listen. I have a feeling that in the United States, and I suspect throughout the English-speaking world, that we've got the best informed mass citizenry in history. I'm not talking about the intellectuals who read all the little magazines. But your average man, I think, now knows more about his world than he ever did before. There's some who wonder whether that's a good thing or not, because it certainly produces action. I think of, particularly in our case, of the Vietnam War. You know, whereas in the 19th century, England could run a little war in India for 2 or 3 years at a time, and nobody paid much attention, even though there would be substantial casualties. But what you got was a rather dramatic and romantic account in the Times 6 weeks after the event. In Vietnam, Americans have had to look at the war night after night in their living rooms and hear about it. And I suspect that's why it's caused so much pain and sorrow in the national character, is because the first war anybody's ever seen. Well, that's public opinion. When we started to get involved heavily in Vietnam in 1965, I think the citizens, like any patriotic citizens, you assume your government is doing the right thing and you support it. And a poll at that time would have indicated probably 80% support for presidential policy. Well, the polls now indicate 75% against presidential policy. And that's purely the result of being informed, not swayed. I'm not talking about a biased advocacy, but just the fact that people know now.
But a cynic might say it took a hell of a long time.
Well, it did. But I think you're dealing with things which are very hard to change. It's, I suppose maybe Irishmen are more sophisticated than Americans about governments. You've had more, and you've gone through more turmoil, and you've had foreign government. It took a long time for Americans to come to the conclusion that their government had made a mistake. Furthermore, we're traditionally supposed to be a highly moral nation, and we're traditionally always supposed to win. We are the straight shooters. It's hard for a country to realize that you've done something wrong and admit it, and to realize that you've lost and admit it.
A sudden shift, or what appears to be a sudden shift, although anybody who's reading the signs of the times knows it wasn't all that sudden, but an apparently sudden shift in policy, like the rapprochement between China and the United States, or at least the beginnings of a rapprochement with President Nixon's projected visit to Peking and all that. How do you think, how will that, as they say, grab the ordinary listener, ordinary viewer, or reader?
Well, I think the first place they're curious. Everybody in the United States has been curious about China. And we've lived with this artificial policy, which nobody really believed in at any high level in government, Republican or Democratic. We've lived with it for 15 years, and I suppose now people are... It's something interesting, and they don't see any particular danger in it. I'm always suspicious of sudden shifts, aren't you?
I don't believe there are such things, really, no.
And if they are, they're probably ill-advised. In other words, if Communist China was a huge villain last year, she is probably whatever she was. I mean, she has not changed. So I cited a little bit with our vice president, Mr. Agnew, who said that just because of a couple of ping-pong games is no reason we should forget with whom we were dealing.
I don't suppose anybody will forget, but do you think that old and much abused, but in the long run not unuseful concept, the balance of powers, will perhaps guarantee, let's say even just hopefully, guarantee perhaps another few years of peace?
I hope so, and I suspect that a feeling about that is what's moving China out of isolation into some kind of rapprochement with a lot of countries, not only the United States. But I think perhaps she had begun to feel that the balance was too heavily on the side of a friendly Russia, friendly to the West. And I suspect this is more of China's doing than ours. We have been sort of waiting to be invited, and at the first invitation, we apparently leap at it.
But you don't stand to lose anything by it.
I don't see how you ever lose by talking, by having some kind of intercourse.
But do you think, again, are you not the voice of sanity, the voice of the open-minded, liberal-minded man, liberal even with a small L? Is there not that hardcore there? At least from where we sit, we get this impression, perhaps distorted, that right across America there is a hardcore which says, why should we talk to them?
It's a very hardcore, but both of our hardcores, to create an impossible kind of fruit, both of our hardcores on the right and left are quite small. They're very vocal, and they're very unyielding, but they're very small. I don't suppose that the kind of people who believe that it's very dangerous to America to have anything to do with communist countries, I don't suppose they would account for more than 2 or 3% of the population.
A lot of people voted for Barry Goldwater.
Yes, but I know Senator Goldwater very well, and of course he would be enthusiastic about opening up conversations with China, I'm sure, without having seen him quoted. Barry Goldwater is a firm man who believed that you're in a war, you should win it, and he believed a great deal in the responsibility of the individual as opposed to a welfare state. But he is by no means a dinosaur.
Well, certainly the Pentagon Papers revelations show that he was by far he was by no means the most hawk-like.
Well, he has... Senator Goldwater has a great disadvantage for an American politician. I suspect the same is true here, is that he is candid and almost certainly prevents the ultimate success if you are candid.
Yes, well, I think we'd all grant him candor. Robin, you had, I think, left the States before the announcement about the Peking meeting. You were there, of course, when the ping-pong politics had begun.
Yes.
But... in general, about the Indochina situation, did you feel that the mood of America was one of hopelessness, or was there light seeming to break through?
Well, it's very hard to say because there's both. There's a feeling of, well, we're maybe almost getting out of there, and then you turn around and think, oh, will it never, never end with more planes going into bomb all the time, even though troops are coming out. And I think it was Abrams said the other day that the soldiers were beginning to feel, oh, well, it's almost over, let's relax, and then, somebody throws a bomb and that's the end. It's the weariest thing that ever happened to our country, and our economy is a mess because of it. And I think, people now feel, everybody, let's get out. I don't know anybody who wants to stay there except the guys who can't get heroin any other place, which is a terrible problem.
Well, of course, one can be moralistic and... one can say it shows the futility of all war, really.
Oh, boy, does it.
Yeah, but this one, of course, has its special horrors. But certainly the mood, the old mood by which if you were against the war in Vietnam, you were some sort of a dropout, has gone, hasn't it?
Oh, yes.
Yes, yes. In general, of course, the pendulum between hope and hopelessness between great faith in the future and moods of cynicism and despair. They're not just proper to America, I suppose. One of the things we, of course, in a country like Ireland, forget about America is, again, this thing that it's so big and it has to include so many kinds of people. And you must have a sense of that yourself when you're there, when you know, commuting as you do between a country like Ireland and America.
Well, of course, America, I think, is much more standardized than Ireland, so that you can go, you know, 1,000 miles and find yourself in the same town that you left, practically. And everybody, as Harry Reasoner was saying, listens to the news. Nobody reads newspaper because there aren't any except the Times, really. And the whole country is fairly standardized. I think you find greater courtesy and people taking more time, you know, as you get farther west. And I don't mean California because that's, you know...
Although you must be careful because to complete our panorama now, we have, well, somebody from California, that's Professor Tom Flanagan, who's head of the English department in Berkeley, and Benedict Kiley, who spent some time as writer in residence in a number of American universities.
Just the other day, I got an invitation from a university debating society. It's from some young lady who thought that because of some articles I had written about the states in a newspaper that I might be a desirable person to oppose a motion. And the motion was that the American dream has become the American nightmare. Now, I'm rather against such, since my days in college, always against these confining and, if I may make a slightly vulgar pun, binding motions that you get in college debating societies. What would interest me would not be a stereotyped argument of this sort, but an attempt by somebody so experienced as our good friend here of the different shades of meaning between dream and nightmare, the different colours and varieties of life.
Our good friend being Professor Tom Flanagan, but do you regard these polarities as being valid at all? Is there such a thing as an American dream?
I'm not sure whether or not they are valid as polarities, but I do think that it is meaningful that people tend to think in those terms, that if there had not been so much talk about an American dream in the past, there would be no need to talk about an American nightmare now, that in a certain sense America has always been a metaphysical country that has moved toward absolutes and has spoken of the American dream. And the other side of the coin of a dream is a nightmare. It's certainly a phrase that you hear elsewhere than in Queens. It's a phrase that you hear often used in America now, and it must have some content to it.
And what is the American dream, or is it possible to sum it up? Is it all that was meant and symbolized in the Statue of Liberty, in the notion of the fusion of many races and many ideas? Is it that sort of thing, do you think?
Well, of course, we on this side of the Atlantic, and very particularly in this country, have been great sharers in the American dream. All the European peoples have, otherwise there wouldn't be so many people in the United States, quite simply. America was the new life. America was the new world. America was opportunity. America was a definition of freedom as against the great absolutist monarchies. America has been all this for so long to so many people. As recently as 1945, many, many European countries were so glad to see America once again as coming as the symbol of liberation. And this, to me, to the European mind, this would have constituted the American dream over the centuries.
And is that the way the American looks at it?
I think that for an American, perhaps one of the great books dealing with the American dream is The Great Gatsby. Fitzgerald uses the phrase, and in the context of that novel, the American dream means an endless future, stretching out as a kind of vista toward which Gatsby stretches his arms. But Gatsby's dream becomes a nightmare. Part of Fitzgerald's meaning is that when you commit yourself that fully toward that kind of a dream, you end with a nightmare. I think it's interesting that nobody has ever talked about the French dream or the Yugoslavian dream or the English dream. It's always the American dream.
I wonder, we had actually, there may not be an Hungarian dream. There is an Hungarian Rhapsody, of course, but we had an Irish dream. We probably still have it.
With Hungarian roots, as I recall.
Shades of Arthur Griffith.
United, free, prosperous, and Talav gan Chias, and the Lord knows what else was part of our dream. We can manage to produce our own varieties of nightmares too, and aren't doing too badly just at the present moment. But the vast scope of America, the great size of it, the trouble about a dream is that it must end. No country, however large, however great its resources, but must come to the time when those resources may be overtaxed and misused. To that extent, American power, because so many young people and so many people in this country and in every other country consider as being misused, just as the power of absolutism was in the past, this is the coming into the nightmare from the dream. The great American resources are being misapplied and misused.
If by resources you mean, as you do, I think, emotional and passional resources as well as material resources, yes. But there is pervasively and increasingly in America a sense that something has gone badly wrong, and there used not to be that sense. And I think that this persuasion or conviction or hunch is the emotional content behind that admittedly ludicrously overstated proposition that the dream has become a nightmare. A feeling that something has gone off the track, that something has gone wrong, and that various possibilities of American life have been blocked out, checked.
And do you think that this is a matter of waking up or stirring in sleep? You know, is this a facing of realities, or is it the vague disturbings of people who are a bit bewildered at things rushing around them in the kaleidoscope of a dream?
Well, what I would like, Sean, to ask Professor Tom Flanagan here is, I wonder, even in the worst days of the Depression, was there that sense of disillusion? The same sense that there is now?
There certainly was a sense, and it was a severe sense. It was accompanied, though, by a kind of optimism which had always been inherent in America, a notion that somehow things would right themselves, that things had temporarily gone off the rails, but that they would move on the rails again, because at least people knew what was wrong. It was a specific economic calamity, although certainly it had roots deep in the society, but essentially it was economic. Here it is more more vague, more general, and interestingly enough, it affects in different ways Americans of very different political opinions. It affects radicals in one way, it affects conservatives in another way. But you don't get the kind of bouncing conservative talk that you used to get as recently as 5 years ago. Middle America is alarmed as it was not alarmed 5 years before.
A certain disillusion?
Yes.
A pessimism?
A fear and an uncertainty.
And is it fear of things, do you think, inherent in the society itself, or just a fear, a xenophobic fear, a fear of the outside?
Well, I remember the last time that Ben visited me in Berkeley, the university was a kind of cauldron of political excitement, not entirely to Ben's pleasure. Now the bubbling in the cauldron is over. The great mass of students, for example, feel profoundly disaffected, but they don't have the sense of action. They are not activist students as you used to get 5 years ago. They are students who do not see really viable options. They are disaffected from the establishment, but they are not moving towards specific political positions.
Do you mean that dropping out on the level of on profound levels is taking place? Dropping out intellectually, dropping out psychologically,
yes.
Closing the doors against.
Yes, right? Yes. And I don't mean just hippies going into communes. I mean on a far wider.
across the table.
Well, you've always had communes, but all this is very interesting because one point about Middle America that struck me while I was there, just about the year that, in fact, in the year of that the Truman Capote book on the Kansas murders was published in cold blood, again and again in various parts of the States I had people from Middle America, well, more or less in touch with academia to some extent too, but not always, asking one questions about what I thought about the violence in American life. Now, it seemed to me a rather odd question because we all knew, even from our childhood reading, that there had always been a great deal of violence in American life. But these people acted and talked as if they were suddenly becoming aware of it, as if they had kept a sort of Caliban down in the basement for a long time and now he was getting out and they didn't know where he came from or what to make of it.
Yes.
And this always puzzled me. Was it that they had shut away any past violence and had so accepted upper and lower middle class values that they just didn't want to think of this, and then all of a sudden it is?
I think that's exactly right. I've always had an eccentric theory that crimes, celebrated crimes, reflect the particular moment of history in which they take place. And the crime that Capote is talking about in Cold Blood is revealing an immensely secure, proper, respectable middle American family suddenly invaded from the outside. Now, the crime of this most recent decade is the Manson case, in which the startling thing is that the people inside the house were as strange in their own way as the people outside the house. No one knows quite what to make of that case. It can't be reduced to the easy categories that Capote was able to reduce in Cold Blood.
So violence then is perhaps now regarded as not just belonging to them, something that they may do, that people are beginning to suspect it's something we may do.
Yes, and a useful suspicion that is, because violence is a property of everyone.
And is there in all this any sort of inherited feelings of vague guilt perhaps to the Indian as well as guilt to the black man, towards the black man?
Yes, that is felt very, very strongly among young people. Very strongly. To the degree that it's felt by adults, it may well be genuine, but I suspect a certain amount of sentimentality as they feel it. But that isn't true of the young. They accept it as a very genuine moral responsibility and guilt.
Yes. And yet, would your final feeling about all this, would it be a dark light? Would there be darkness in your final view of this?
Not with me, it wouldn't. It may be that I just have a sort of optimistic temperament that has kept one up to date from cutting one's own throat and smaller problems. But Maratha did say that one thing that might save the United States was the possibility that the truth might be told there. Another thing is that I was always amazed in American colleges by the number of young people who, aside from their studies, were doing voluntary work that personally put me to shame, considering the sort of slouch I was when I was going to college myself. And on these good young people, and indeed on the many genuinely good and hard-working people of, you know, more advanced ages, I think a country can cast hope.
I hope you're right.
America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea.
That was a song we all knew as children, and oh boy, did we believe it then. And I think maybe, you know, there are people who still believe it now.
Hold up. Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save